Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. For years, physicians have relied on opioids as the first line of treatment for their patients' pain. The trend has led to the opioid addiction crisis across the country, including in Ohio, which is among the hardest hit states. The Joint Commission, a nonprofit organization that accredits more than 21,000 U.S. healthcare organizations and programs, has released new pain standards to address the problem. Starting next year, doctors and hospitals will be required to provide drug-free pain treatment methods. A pain management program at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, has for more than four decades used alternative methods to treat pain. Wesley Gilliam is a clinical psychologist and director of the Pain Rehabilitation Center at the Mayo Clinic. He joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann. Thanks for having me.
Why did the Mayo Clinic get involved in this kind of treatment alternative four decades ago?
Well, I think this is no mystery. For a long, long time, we've recognized that chronic pain is a very, very complicated problem, and it's influenced by lots and lots of different variables, and simply targeting symptom amelioration, which is a more traditional medical approach to treating pain, is often insufficient for a lot of patients with chronic pain. So I think Mayo has been at the forefront of this interdisciplinary approach for a long period of time, recognizing the complexity of this problem.
How do pain medications work? What do opioids do?
Sure. Well, first, let's start with opioids can be an appropriate approach in the right setting. So opioids are very appropriate for acute pain and very appropriate for palliative care. That's essentially what they've been designed to do. They block opioid receptors in the brain to prevent release of neurotransmitters that cause chronic pain. They block pain signals from the periphery to the brain. But what we've begun to discover over the course of time is that when used long-term, used chronically, they actually lose their effectiveness over the course of time. And more importantly, patients, these are substances that patients, their bodies begin to adjust to these medications, and they need increasingly higher doses in order to get the same effect. And now, as we've sort of let the toothpaste out of the tube and begin using these in inappropriate ways, we're starting to discover that the medications themselves can actually contribute to pain, and they're also associated with lots and lots of negative side effects.
How can the medications themselves contribute to the pain?
Well, there's a phenomenon called opioid-induced hyperalgesia, and where the mu receptors in the brain that are being blocked by these opioids actually become sensitized by the opioids themselves and can have a paradoxical effect. So as opposed to them ameliorating pain or reducing the symptom severity, they actually can ratchet up the symptoms in particular patients. I don't know that I could necessarily pinpoint the specific patients that are susceptible to this type of thing, but it is something that's been emerging and we're starting to recognize as a problem.
In treating, well, first of all, psychologically, how does pain work in our brains? How is that working?
Sure. So, you know, I have to be careful as a psychologist when I present this information to patients, because for many of the folks we work with, they're hurting and the extent of their pain is a bit disproportionate from what we would expect medically. So the psychology of pain is not about people imagining their pain or that it's all in their head, but rather how people respond to pain symptoms influences how they experience their condition. Pain is a very, very subjective problem, and thus it's influenced by people's interpretations. So how one thinks about pain and interprets it is going to play a big role in how they experience it. So you can have two people with very, very similar conditions, and based on how they respond to their symptoms, they may have much different functional status. Some may be functioning quite well despite having their pain condition and still actively involved in their life. Others may be completely functionally impaired. It's difficult to reconcile those discrepancies if you look at it from a purely medical perspective. You have to take into consideration the idiosyncrasies of each patient. They bring their own experiences, their own interpretations, and those variables influence how they function with their symptoms.
How does the Mayo program work? How do you approach these cases?
Sure. So we're very focused on functional restoration. This is not a program that's designed to take people's pain away. We don't advertise it that way, and we're very transparent about that at the start of treatment for every patient that we have. our goal is to identify what things have you lost in your life that you want to regain, and how can we get you doing those things through very, very targeted, focused physical therapy, daily reconditioning of the body, pain psychology, so helping patients develop strategies to cope with the pain symptoms that they have. Occupational therapy is a big component of what we do as well, and advanced relaxation, which we call biofeedback training.
How does biofeedback work? Why does that help?
Sure. So we have a remarkable ability to manipulate our own physiology. And so what biofeedback does is we hook patients up to these machines which measure various aspects of physiology, so respiration rate, heart rate, peripheral skin temperature, etc. And we work with patients to develop relaxation strategies, and the biofeedback machine can actually provide feedback to the patient showing how their physiology is changing as they're implementing relaxation strategies. It's actually quite remarkable.
I read in the New York Times that the brain can become addicted to dramatizing pain. What does that mean?
Sure. Well, the more that we are preoccupied with our pain, the more we think about our pain as some unmanageable catastrophe, the more the brain becomes conditioned or primed to respond to pain in that way. So from a functional rehab standpoint, what we work with our patients on is really not focusing at all on the pain. And that might seem virtually impossible for many, but the more we talk about pain, the more we become preoccupied with the symptoms and the impact that it's having on us, the more the brain becomes sensitive to it. So what we work to do in a functional program like ours is to redirect people's focus away from the symptoms. There's an acknowledgement that the symptoms exist and they're impactful, but the focus is not on how problematic it's been, but rather what do we need to do different to manage those symptoms in the moment.
Can you give me an example of how you redirect somebody?
Well, I mean, we see it on a daily basis. Folks will come in into the doors at 8 a.m. when we start, and we'll have a flare-up of symptom that's virtually inevitable. That's going to happen at some point. It might be I'm having a really bad headache day, or my low back pain is really flared up. Instead of stopping, shutting it down, and saying, let's go back to the hotel or to your home and recover and come back tomorrow, we're going to work with the patients to continue to work through the day, every aspect of the program, irrespective of how bad the symptoms are. And what we tend to find is that by the end of the day, the patients will tell us, it was a rough morning, but the symptoms actually got much better as I got more engaged in my day. That typically does not happen when people avoid their days and they stay home when they're hurting. That's an example of how if you actively engage the brain in other activities, it doesn't have as much attentional focus on the pain because it's being directed elsewhere.
The Joint Commission that I described earlier recently rolled out a new report on pain assessment and management standards that will go into effect at the start of the next year. What do you make of those?
Well, I think there's clearly a broader recognition of the importance of comprehensive assessment of pain and making strong clinical decisions about what are the appropriate treatment approaches. Opiates have, unfortunately, it appears, been really increased in terms of their utilization in chronic pain, despite the fact that we don't have a lot of empirical support suggesting that they're effective long-term. So I'm fully in support of more comprehensive evaluation. We have to develop more accessibility of empirically based treatments for chronic pain and reduce our overall reliance on these opioid medications that are just simply not demonstrated to be terribly helpful.
Has there been a lot of empirical investigation of treating pain without them, treating pain with something like the Mayo program?
Absolutely. So Mayo program, there's published data, a lot of published data on pain rehabilitation programs and the efficacy of these programs. They've been in existence for quite some time. Now, there's not enough of these types of programs around the country, in my opinion, but these aren't new. The support is there, the support for cognitive behavioral therapy, which is a psychosocial treatment approach for chronic pain, has repeatedly been demonstrated to be very effective with chronic pain patients.
What about things like acupuncture, acupressure, Reiki, that kind of a thing, those kinds of treatments?
There is certainly some empirical literature out there supporting those types of treatments for specific types of pain conditions, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's less of data on those than there are for pain rehab programs and more cognitively focused treatment programs, but they are out there. But ultimately, when you get to a point where we have a patient who is incredibly functionally impaired, the patients that come to see us have typically exhausted many of those treatment options. Many of those options are what I would consider to be more passive treatment approaches. That is, I'm not saying these aren't appropriate treatments for certain patients, don't mm-hmm. get me wrong. But for the patients that we work with at a tertiary level, these patients have exhausted these options, and these passive approaches encourage patients to come into the healthcare system. We will deliver an intervention to you, and then you're going to go home, and we're going to hope that it works. But what if it doesn't? That's where our folks run into problems. With pain rehab programs, what we're doing is focusing on any skill that these patients get from us is portable. They can take it home with them, they can implement it themselves, and they can use it to self-manage their symptom and improve their quality of life. So there are a myriad options in terms of pain treatment. Really, it's different than any other disease. There's no other disease that has as many pain specialists as chronic pain does. And some of these treatment options may be very appropriate for some patients, but patients who have long-term refractory pain conditions, they typically aren't effective, and we've got to get them working on developing skills to manage their own conditions.
What are the most typical causes of chronic pain for people who have never experienced it? Is it all over your body? Is it just in certain parts of your body? What do we even mean by it?
Range of potential chronic pain conditions. Some conditions are very localized to one specific area, such as a chronic low back pain. That's the most prevalent pain condition that we have in this country. And then there are some patients who will come with very diffuse chronic pain. So they're hurting. They have a lot of tissue sensitivity all over their bodies, such as a fibromyalgia diagnosis. The problem with diffuse conditions is that in some instances, particularly fibromyalgia, there is no clear pain generator in the periphery. So they're hurting, but we're not able to pinpoint an explanation as to why.
Is that pretty rare?
I wouldn't say it's rare, no. I mean, we see it quite a bit here in our program, actually. And there are also some conditions that start very local. So they start in one area of the body, and as they go on and they continue to be very poorly managed, people with one chronic pain condition are very susceptible to additional chronic pain conditions. So they can actually develop it in other areas of their body.
Nick in Waldo, you're on the air with Wesley Gilliam, clinical psychologist and director of the Pain Rehabilitation Center at the Mayo Clinic. Hi, Nick.
Hi, how's it going?
Good.
Good morning, Nick.
Morning. I was calling about, I am 36 years old. When I was 15, I had a dirt bike accident, which broke my neck collarbone. They ended up finding a tumor on my spine. So I've been through pain management ever since, pretty much. So through the OxyContin epidemic and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And everything that you're saying is good in theory, but what about the people that need to work every day? Because that's pretty time consuming. I went through that, like chiropractors and stuff, and I had Medicaid for a minute, but when the Medicaid ran out, I couldn't go because it was too expensive. Mm-hmm. And I had to work on top of that. Mm-hmm. So isn't that all this, I don't know what you'd call it, like rehabilitation, isn't it time-consuming and expensive?
Wesley Gilliam?
Sure. So, Nick, it is time-consuming. Our program is a three-week daily program for 15, so it's 17 consecutive days. There's no question that it is time-consuming. But what we have to ask ourselves is the investment in those 3 weeks in terms of costs and missed work, is that investment worth the potential long-term benefit of keeping people employed? and keeping people more functional and engaged in their lives.
Do you find companies are more willing to make this kind of investment if the individuals can't afford it?
It depends on the company. You know, not every insurance policy covers what we do. Nick makes a very good point there as well. That is a challenge that we face in this country, is getting people more access to programs like these.
Nick, good luck. I wonder if Nick isn't the most common sufferer out there, is the one who's not part of the 1%, doesn't have a lot of money.
Sure.
Is it expensive?
It's an expensive program, and there are a select few who do pay out of pocket, but a majority of the patients that we work with, their insurance is covering it for them.
Okay. I want to thank you, Wesley Gilliam, for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me, Ann.
Wesley Gilliam is a clinical psychologist and director of the Pain Rehabilitation Center at the Mayo Clinic. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Aging is inevitable, yet hundreds of anti-aging beauty products claim to erase wrinkles, fade sunspots, and achieve the elusive fountain of youth. This month, Allure magazine has resolved to put a stop to using the term anti-aging. Author and science journalist Arlene Weintraub has written about the anti-aging industry. Her 2010 book is entitled Selling the Fountain of Youth: How the Anti-Aging Industry Made a Disease Out of Getting Old and Made Billions. Arlene joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
How did you first wander into this world of anti-aging and analyze it as such?
Well, I was working on staff as a reporter at Business Week magazine. I was covering the biotechnology industry, actually, and one of the very first biotech drugs was human growth hormone, which was used to treat children who were not growing normally. And as I researched this drug, I came across this kind of shadow industry, the anti-aging industry, which had latched onto human growth hormone and was. And these were doctors that were prescribing it to perfectly healthy, full-grown adults because they believed that it would stop them from getting older. And the more I looked into it, the more I found different substances being prescribed, estrogen, progesterone, that were kind of alternative versions of drugs and doctors telling patients that it would prevent them from getting old.
When did the U.S. really see a boom in anti-aging medicine and regimens?
It was really in the 1990s that this started to take off. It was driven largely by baby boomers who didn't want to age in the same way that they saw their parents age. They didn't want to become elderly and frail. They wanted to keep exercising and working and having the strength to do that. And so they started, really buying into this idea that you don't have to get old. And it affected not just their consumption of medical products, but also the consumption of cosmetics, which the cosmetics industry really latched onto that term anti-aging at about that time.
There is no such thing as anti-aging, right?
Well, it's a mindset for sure. I mean, certainly you can choose to be anti-aging. In my opinion, it's not a very constructive term because we all are going to age, and we need to embrace it and find a way to work with it and take constructive approaches to aging in a healthy manner. So the term anti-aging doesn't really promote that idea. And I think that was part of the thinking for the move that was taken by Allure magazine, which you mentioned, which I thought was fantastic, by the way.
Yeah, it sort of kind of the pot calling the kettle black in a way. It's allure's part of the problem?
Well, I think that women's magazines naturally become part of the problem because they get so much of their advertising from the cosmetics industry, which is still, unfortunately, using that term widely. I did a search today for anti-aging serum, and I got almost 15 million hits. And they were companies, large and small, household names. I'm not going to name them, but we all know them, and they're still using that term. So yes, I think that women's magazines become part of the problem sort of unwittingly, but it certainly will help that they're not going to use it in the editorial in the magazine.
Right. It's very interesting. Why do you think, or what have you learned about why the baby boomer generation was particularly affected by this trend?
Well, I think there were several reasons. Like I said, they had seen their parents age and become frail, and didn't want to be. They didn't want to emulate that. It's a generation that has worked well into their old age, more so than previous generations, and they wanted to have the energy to continue pursuing their careers, and so that, I think, drove a lot of it. Another big part of it was menopause and women really driving this trend. The actress Suzanne Somers wrote several books promoting this idea of bioidentical estrogen and progesterone, which she said mimic what your body makes naturally, and she kind of promoted this idea of taking these hormones, which are really just manufactured hormones like any other sort of anti-hot flash product, and she promoted them as natural and what your body makes naturally, and it can't hurt you, and it's going to prevent you from aging, and that idea kind of really took off largely because of this celebrity endorsement.
When you talk to doctors who are promoting these kinds of claims and these kinds of medicines, what do they say? How do they defend themselves?
Well, they say that really what's happening as we age is that our hormones levels are declining naturally, and that is true. That is what happens when we age. And they say all we're doing is restoring those levels of hormones back to where they were when you were in your 20s and 30s. And there's nothing wrong with this. It's perfectly natural. And many of them, I was kind of stunned to discover, were doing these hormone treatments themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they had really bought into it. It was almost like a cult. And they would say to their patients, look, I'm doing it and I look great and I feel great and no harm can come from this. And at the same time, they really didn't produce any scientific trials or studies to show that it is safe. And there's plenty of evidence out there that it actually might not be safe for healthy people to kind of boost their hormone levels unnaturally.
Then with all the regulatory, entities out there, why in the world do they get to sell this stuff and profit from it?
Well, there's part of the pharmaceutical industry that's called compounding pharmacies.
Uh-huh.
And what they do is they take drugs that are FDA approved and on the market, and they take the ingredients of those drugs and they mix them up into their own concoctions and sell them as anti-aging treatments. And that industry also really took off in the 1990s. It's largely unregulated. And I've been happy to see, actually, over the past few years that the FDA has stepped up and tightened the regulations that affect compounding pharmacies. But they're not preventing the pharmacies from selling the treatments and marketing them. You can go online and look for bioidentical estrogen, find plenty that you can get an easy prescription for. Not necessarily from your doctor, just a prescription online.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's unfortunate, but some of the regulations have tightened up, but a lot more could be done, in my opinion.
You write about the nonprofit American Academy of Anti-Aging Medicine. It was established in 1992 by Drs. Ronald Klatz and Robert Goldman. What were they shooting for there?
Well, what they do is they train other doctors that are interested in starting anti-aging clinics, and they teach them about human growth hormone and bioidentical estrogen and progesterone and testosterone, which is another big part of this industry. They also confer upon physicians a certificate. They call it a specialty, except it's not officially a specialty. It's not really recognized by the mainstream medical organizations. So you know, it's kind of, yes, they may call themselves a nonprofit, but a lot of money is being made not only by that organization but also by the physicians that practice anti-aging medicine, because they do this outside the realm of the insurance industry. Anti-aging medicine is not usually reimbursed by insurance companies because, of course, aging is not a disease, so you can't put a claim in for it. And so so patients really have to pay out of pocket, and it can be quite lucrative
physicians. Has it made the people who do need, like children you mentioned, the human growth hormone, has it made it more expensive for people who do need it?
No, because people who do need it, and there are people who are naturally deficient in human growth hormone, that will be reimbursed by the insurance industry, but those are actual diseases that cause people to be deficient in hormones and need to replace them. So it's that distinction. It's a fine line, but most insurance companies understand the distinction. The FDA understands the distinction.
There's a chapter in your book entitled "The Invention of Male Menopause." What's the significance there?
Well, like I said before, the prescribing of testosterone is a big part of the anti-aging industry. There are several brands of pharmaceutical testosterone. People may remember a few years ago, there were ads on television, "Do you have low T?" Low T stands for low testosterone. And again, there are some men who are severely deficient in testosterone, and they do need to be treated, but the pharmaceutical industry started reaching out to everyday men who are just getting older and maybe feeling a little tired, a little loss of libido, and advertising these products for those men. And it's interesting, since the book came out, there is now a big class action lawsuit. Pharmaceutical testosterone was tied to an increased risk of cardiac events like heart attack and stroke, and there are now hundreds of men suing, believing that their heart attacks and strokes were caused by testosterone. So it'd be interesting to see how that plays out.
Yeah, definitely. Botox is approved by the FDA to erase wrinkles and treat some muscle disorders. You wrote that the maker of Botox had also marketed it to treat headaches. What's this about, and what are the rules for off-label marketing in these cases?
Well, yes, the maker of Botox did get in trouble for some off-label marketing. They have done studies for other uses of the drug, and they actually have gotten FDA approval for those other uses. It's a rare example of a company that for the most part has done the responsible thing and gone out and done the studies to show that the drug does what they're advertising it for. But the FDA has over the years come to the company and said, no, you have to stop saying this in your ads because you're overselling the product. So, you know, it's sort of a double-edged sword dealing with regulators. You need to do the right thing to not get in trouble, but by making yourself visible with an anti-aging product, you're definitely vulnerable to being told to stop what you're doing and stop what you're promoting.
How did Botox contribute to the growth of anti-aging medicine? It wasn't really about that. It just changes the musculature, right?
Right. Well, once the company discovered that it had the power to erase wrinkles and went out and got the FDA approval for that use, it really kind of drove a lot of the anti-aging industry, because here was a product that needs to be administered by a physician, and it does erase the outward signs of aging. And it was really embraced and continues to be widely used.
Yeah, there's like Botox parties and that kind of a thing now.
Right, right.
Yeah. Do they know what they're getting into as a rule?
I think it depends. In the case of bioidentical hormones that are manufactured by compounding pharmacists, mm-hmm. and that are sold by compounding pharmacists, they might not know what they're getting into. That's because those pharmacists do not have to put warning labels on their products like a pharmaceutical company has to. So if you are prescribed an FDA-approved form of estrogen, you will get a lot of warnings about estrogen being tied to various side effects. But if you get a bioidentical hormone that's made by your corner pharmacy, you might not get those warnings. And I think that's caused a lot of confusion among patients of anti-aging medicine, because they don't quite understand that it's the same ingredient. It's pharmaceutical estrogen, and it doesn't matter who's making it. It still carries those same risks.
Is there a next generation of all of this coming down the pike, or do you see people pulling away from it? What do you expect?
You know, that's a good question. I think it's going to largely be a generational thing, and my hope is that it will die out, and that future generations will understand the concept of aging is inevitable, and we shouldn't be anti-aging. We should take proactive steps to age in a healthy manner. And I think, by the way, that decisions like the one that Allure made could be very important in shaping the attitudes of the millennial generation. And I certainly hope that millennials don't embrace the term anti-aging and instead embrace things like exercise, which is the only thing that's been shown to actually slow down the aging process. You know, so it will be interesting to see what happens.
Arlene Weintraub, thanks for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
Arlene Weintraub is a science journalist and author of Selling the Fountain of Youth, How the Anti-Aging Industry Made a Disease Out of Getting Old and Made Billions. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The loss of a newborn child is a tragedy no parent should have to experience. Ohio, however, has consistently fallen near the bottom of state rankings in infant mortality rates. According to Columbus Public Health, in 2016, there were 165 infant deaths in Franklin County. That's nearly 9 deaths per every 1,000 births. The national average is 6 for every 1,000 births. But the number of deaths is falling in Columbus in part from the Celebrate One initiative to reduce infant mortality rates. Shawnai Scott and Nathan Hurd have both lost children due to unsafe sleeping habits. They now work to teach other parents about safe sleeping practices, and we welcome them today. Nathan Hurd serves on the executive committee of Celebrate One. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you.
And Shawnai Scott Miller is a community health worker with Celebrate One. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you.
Shawnai, I'm sorry, I mispronounced it. Nathan, your son died while sleeping with a blanket.
Yeah.
Tell us what happened.
So it was by far the worst day of my life. He was at our babysitter's, and I actually brought this blanket in. I know the listeners can't see it, but it's a small, tiny blanket that might be, you know, 12 inches by 12 inches, and it's got a little,
just a little banky.
Stuffed animal sewed onto it. And all of our kids had one of these, and he was at our babysitter's, and she laid him down for his afternoon nap, and he didn't wake up. And it's just, I could walk you through it, but I think it's safe to say, even though everyone's different, it's your worst nightmare come true.
Yeah. So I see these around all the time.
Yeah.
They're still out there. They're just not age appropriate.
You know, I don't think there's anything wrong with these blankets. The issue is when you put a blanket or anything else like that in a crib with a baby who's sleeping, they can be problematic for some kids, right? In my case, I believe this blanket played an integral role in my son's passing. When they found him, when the babysitter found him, the blanket had worked its way up over his face. And a normal child would respond by probably moving the blanket away. But for some reason, there's some children that have an underlying vulnerability in their brain stems. And, he didn't respond normally. And as a result, I think this blanket played a role in it. And I think it's an important part of why we're here, because, you know, the research now shows that babies should sleep alone on their backs and in an empty crib for every sleep. And I think this blanket helps to really humanize that and show, you know, it's not some scary, you know, crazy sleep environment. It was, you know, it's the simply seemingly innocent little blanket.
And lots of people, Shanae, sleep with their babies.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Tell us what happened.
With me, it was like just a normal Tuesday night. You know, as a new mom, you're going to be tired. You're going to have that restlessness. Laying in a bed, bonding with her, making faces, you know, communicating with her. Just, I feel like normal mother type, you know,
right,
things.
Right, exactly.
Especially as a first-time mother. This is my first baby. Laying her in the bed next to me. And, like intentionally, I didn't mean to fall asleep. But, you know, being tired, having those late nights with her, I end up falling asleep right after she did. Now, instead of putting her in her bassinet, you know, I didn't think anything would be wrong or anything would happen with just leaving her in the bed right next to me, and I end up falling asleep. The next morning, I wake up, and it's me waking up, talking to her, you know, feeling, like, really refreshed. Like, I slept longer than, you know, normal. You know, first-time moms, you're up all night, you know, up and down.
Remember.
With her, I was asleep for a very long time, and it just didn't feel right. So I'm talking to her and, you know, expecting some type of sound or something. And I look over and she looks as if she's still asleep. So I pick her up, you know, just, you know, she's not waking up. So I picked her up. And when I picked her up, she was kind of cool to the touch and her color was a little different. That's when I was looking for signs of breathing, feeling to see if she was breathing. Once I realized she wasn't, I actually started performing CPR. Was a little frantic, hollered for my sister, who was downstairs, and she came up and kind of took over from there, and also had someone call 911 that was also downstairs. And from there, it was just
every parent's nightmare.
Yes.
I'm so sorry. So sorry for both of you. And I said it off the air, and I'll say it on. Thank you so much for sharing your stories. These are normal things that people think are very normal and don't think anything of them. Nathan, a babysitter, you said, was watching your son. Well, how much is the Celebrate One reaching out to secondary caregivers as well?
It's a really important question, because I think, you know, whether it be a babysitter or an aunt, an uncle, you know, a grandparent, something like that, you know, a lot of times we trust our children with other people, other caregivers, right? It's an important audience that we pay attention to, and it's an important focus of the campaign that we have, you know, the ABCs of Safe Sleep.
Right, right. So tell us about the ABCs of Safe Sleep, Shanae.
The ABCs of Safe Sleep is A, alone, B, on the back, and then C is in the empty crib. So it could be any type of sleep space as long as, you know, it's safe. There's no blankets, no pillows, no toys, things of that nature. You want to be completely empty. And they provide sleep blankets and things of that nature to make sure the baby stays cool or warm enough, even in different seasons. So you don't necessarily need to put a blanket in with the baby. So you don't want no type of anything that could suffocate the baby, especially that young, when they're not able to lift their heads or being able to turn when, you know, they feel like they can't breathe.
So that's what a lot of people worry about, is they're going to be cold. Or they put the little blanket in to comfort them. I remember babysitting when I was 100 years ago, when I would babysit. And the thing then was to put them on their tummy. Who studies these things? How do these things evolve, these ABCs?
I think evolve is the right word. You know, in all likelihood, these sudden, unexpected infant deaths or SUIDs, SIDS is the most common variation of SUID or sleep-related death that people might, you know, hear. In all likelihood, these deaths have been happening for ages and ages and ages. But this evolution starts to first recognize, you know, the patterns, and then they start working to identify what's causing that. And to answer your question, who studies this? There's a number of groups. The American Academy of Pediatrics, the National Institute of Health. You know, the American Academy of Pediatrics are, in my view, having kind of experienced this and paid a lot more attention to it since, they are the authority, and they are the ones who you know, make the recommendations that lead to campaigns like the ABCs of Safe Sleep.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the ABCs of Safe Sleep with two people who've learned the hard way. Sadly, Shawnee Scott Miller is a mother who fell asleep with her baby in her bed, and she's now a community health worker with Celebrate One. It's an organization looking to lower the infant mortality rate in Central Ohio. Also, Nathan Hurd, the father of a son who died while sleeping with a blanket, and serves on the executive committee of Celebrate One. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Shawnee, researchers have studied how black babies born in the United States are more than twice as likely as white ones to die before their first birthdays. And you're black.
Mm-hmm.
Were you aware of that risk, that it might be higher for you? How did you, or did, is it the learn the hard way road?
The learn the hard way road, definitely. As a first-time mom, obviously, I was nervous with becoming a mother to begin with.
Sure.
I got pregnant at 23, which was a planned pregnancy. So I went to my prenatal appointments, took my medication. So, you know, essentially, I thought I was safe. You know, I was doing everything right. And you know, that's the belief I had. So after she passed and everything, I was looking more into it. And I realized that I also lived in, they call it a red zone, which is an area throughout Columbus that have certain areas that have a higher
rate.
Yeah, like a higher rate. Uh-huh. They have higher rate of infant mortality. And I think Ohio, they started out with maybe 8 zones, and now it's actually gotten lower since, you know, the Celebrate One initiative to lower it. But I was actually living in one of the safe zones when I lost my baby. So that definitely was new. It was news to me after she had passed that I was actually living in 43207 area code.
And just even being alerted to that might have made you more vigilant?
Yes, definitely. If I would have known or been a little bit more educated on the fact that it could happen to just anybody, even as prepared as I felt that I was, I would have, you know, been a little bit more educated, maybe aware.
You know, it scares anybody, though, to think about what happened, because, you know, you're describing a situation that's very common and wonderful.
Right.
Talking with your baby, you're home from work, you have that quiet, calm time, and you fell asleep.
Right.
What would you have done differently? You know,
I would have taken... What is it, a minute or two? Literally, her bassinet was literally right next to my bed.
As soon as she was asleep.
Yeah, as soon as she had fallen asleep. Or I felt myself even getting fatigued to the fact that I could have fell asleep. I would have just put her in her bassinet, which was literally right next to my bed.
Right.
Just a few seconds, if that takes, to put your baby there.
Celebrate One's initiative has helped to reduce the number of infant deaths. In 2016, there were 165 total infant deaths in Franklin County. That's 8.7 deaths per 1,000 births. And according to Columbus Public Health, the national rate's 6 out of 100 out of 1,000. Is there any sense from within the ranks of Celebrate One about why there's been this impact, why it's been able to lower it?
Yeah, it's complicated.
Yeah,
and quite frankly, it gets into some topics that are challenging. I mean, we're starting to deal with, like Shanae was saying, you know, some of the social determinants of health, and you know, the reality is we have 8 neighborhoods in our community that contribute disproportionately to the number of sleep related infant deaths. It's it's hard. You know, you got to get in there and figure out why is that happening. In terms of why we believe the numbers are coming down, we're cautiously optimistic that it's some of the efforts that we're putting forward. There's no one magic bullet. There's no one magic panacea to fix this. You've got to address multitude of issues from communication to cultural barriers. So we're cautiously optimistic by the data showing that it's coming down. But, you know, let's be frank. This is not a sprint. We're talking about changing behavior and raising awareness, and this is going to be a marathon. And the numbers are looking good now, and we're hopefully saving lives right now. But
it has to be persistent.
It has to be persistent.
Shanae, what do you think? I mean, about that, the coming from that neighborhood, being there, then you found about it later. What do you think? What are your why those neighborhoods?
Well, obviously, I think the culture in that area, in the areas that the zip codes represent, mm-hmm. A lot of the cultures are different. Most of the times, barriers that we have, a lot of moms can't afford, safe sleep areas. A lot of moms can't afford to have multiple bedrooms or places for babies to sleep mm-hmm. safely. A lot of times, sleeping with your baby is normalized in our culture. So, you would think the safest place for them to be is, in your arms or with you
right.
at all times. So, just getting this education out there and letting them know that it's not considered safe anymore.
Yeah.
I just want to build on that. I mean, I think the racial piece of that is important, but let's be clear. These eight neighborhoods are not just black neighborhoods.
Oh, right. Right. They're not. Yeah. Right. Exactly.
We have.
Is there any unifying factor, though?
Yeah, it's broadly categorized as social determinants of health. So you typically have, lower income,
yeah.
lower education.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the information that comes out from medical jargon is hard to translate. It's hard to, I remember.
For anybody, it's just.
I wanted desperately to understand what happened when my son died. And, I have a master's degree. And I had to sit down and I read these. First of all, I had to go find journal articles and I got a dictionary and I read and I had to look up words so I can understand or try to understand what they were saying.
Right.
I mean, think about that for someone who, wasn't as fortunate as me to go and get a master's degree. I think that communication piece and making sure that you can get that information out is critical.
Shanae, you work with the program Moms to Be, and we've mm-hmm. talked about that on this program before. Mm-hmm. It's a great program. How does that Moms to Be embrace the ABCs and other infant death issues?
Our Moms to Be program is a prenatal program. So we take moms while they're still pregnant and we educate them on safe sleep, a healthy diet, things they can do to have a healthy pregnancy. We also offer resources. As my role as a community health worker, one of my roles is to help moms overcome those barriers. So safe sleep being one of the biggest ones, obviously. And we have different cultures at Moms to Be. So it's not just black moms. We have
right.
different cultures. We offer ways to get a free pack and play that comes with that sleeping sack. So you don't have to use a blanket. We offer education on basically eating healthy and offer incentives for coming to the program to help with eating healthy, eating better foods, the diets or whatever. So it's like taking those initiatives, those barriers, and creating solutions for them is helping moms and helping them understand and even educating. And I provide face to the program and to the safe sleep. You hear about stories and you can read about them, but talking to somebody face to face that has actually experienced it,
yeah.
I think has made a big difference because, you can tell stories all day until you hear from the person, from the mouth of the
yeah.
person that actually has gone through it. I feel like it makes a big, big difference.
Well, thank you for sharing your story today. I really appreciate
no
it. That's Shanae Scott-Miller. She works as a community health worker with Celebrate One. And also Nathan Hurd, thanks to you as well.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Nathan Hurd serves on the executive committee of Celebrate One. Both of them have shared their stories today on how they lost their own children due to unsafe sleeping practices. They've learned the hard way and are trying to help others learn the easy way. Thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.